Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
How are you on pickles on sandwiches?
Love pickles.
Big pickle guy.
Extra pickles.
Extra pickle guy. You know, back in the day when I used to intern at PTI, I would get about two of those potbelly pickles to bring back to the newsroom, and often one of them would be given to Frankie Nation or somebody else.
That was the internship that was cut short because you had other agenda.
Well, it was a busy summer. Tony, John Kerry doesn't windsurf alone, okay? So sorry.
The Tony Kornheiser Show is on now.
Luke.
They don't make them like they used to. No. They broke the mold, my friends.
No. That's Chris Saliz's voice. Chris is sitting with us today. There's a bunch of small things to start with. I snuck out and played golf yesterday. It was a beautiful day. I got out early, about 7:45 in the morning, so that I was done before I had to call into the PTI call and all that. I play from front tees. I play about a 5,300 yard course.
You're now basically teeing off in the fairway.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I had one par. It's pathetic.
But you played quickly.
How many birdies, though?
No birdies. What? I had one par. And the only reason I got that par was because I made a really good chip to 2 feet on a par three on number eight. I'm truly bad now. I don't understand it. I didn't drive the ball. I didn't do anything well. I enjoyed myself like crazy. I played in 3 hours.
You still enjoy it, though.
I think
right?
we need to go back to your old rocket balls, driver. You never miss the fairway with that thing.
Just
how do you is a quite relevant question for me because I have to. My wife has roped me into playing on some pro-am thing on Monday, and I'm dreading it. How do
with
you
actual pros?
No. It's like a. It's not a pro-am. It's a a bunch of foursomes to raise money for it. It's a fundraiser.
Okay.
How do you enjoy it? Because I don't enjoy
it.
You just like being out there?
Yeah,
focus
like
on the being
fast.
Out there?
I don't mind. If I hit three really bad shots in a row, like with a pitching wedge and I scull it and it goes over the green,
it
costs me three more shots, I just pick it up at that point. But I still enjoy it. I still enjoy every time hitting the next shot. I do.
I got to get to that place.
What happens to your heart rate once you see the ball trickle into a bunker? Because you freeze.
Very problematic for me.
Just throw it out.
I did that the other day.
Winter rules.
Nice judge.
Also, I think I have developed something incredibly painful on my left foot, a bunion.
Ooh.
Oh.
It really hurts. Every time I step down, every time I touch it, in that area where the end of your big toe, not the outer end, the inner end of your big toe, to the right of that, this is on my left foot, to the right of that, there's this large sort of extrusion.
Yeah, that's where bunions are, man.
Have you ever had them?
No, but my dad did. That's where you get
them.
They hurt like hell, right?
They really hurt. Yep. I don't know what to do about it. I do know what to do about it.
Bunion treatment.
This is why I'm talking about it now. because I'm sure that we have podiatrists and or chiropodists who listen to this show. When I was younger, there were two, there were podiatrists and chiropodists. I do not know the difference, but I expect there is a difference in both our foot doctors. But you're looking at me quizzically because
I've never heard of chiropodist in my life.
So that may be gone now. So they may all just be podiatrists.
Wait, was one like a surgeon and one a... I don't know.
Do they laser this off of your toe?
Can I tell you
this? I don't know. It's not on my toe. It's on the bone. It's on the bone on the right-hand side of my left foot.
So this is not related to the fact that you haven't cut your toenails in years?
No.
I don't worry about that. Just for the record, I just looked up bunion treatment.
Oh, okay, yes.
The first thing that
lasering,
comes up...
isn't it?
The first thing that comes up, this is not encouraging. Fix bunion all naturally. Fix bunions without metal. Without metal? What is that? What is it? Like they
so
press
like
it down maybe?
You can't press it down. No,
it
you go through the
too
roof.
Bad, right?
You go through the roof if they press it down.
Painful bunions can be... treatments include changing shoes, padding the foot, and pain medication, which is, you know... Painful bunions can be removed surgically.
Yeah, is there anything like a non-painful bunion? I wouldn't think so. But I was sort of hoping there was a cream or, you know, drops that would shrink. I don't know what
the Mayo Clinic says apply ice.
Yeah. Ice.
Yeah.
That's what Kevin Sheehan says. He says apply ice to everything. Everything. Kevin Sheehan.
He says to
ice.
Get surgery for everything.
Get surgery.
Three steps to treating your bunion. Number one, apply ice.
Yeah, that's what he wants to do.
Keys to the bunion.
So you're probably asking, well, are you even going to talk about the basketball game? Basketball game stunk. I'm so glad I didn't watch it because it stunk. At the end of the first half, Denver was up 59 to 42. There's no coming back for that if you're shooting like 20% from the field as Miami was. Miami's shooters, take Jimmy Butler out of it. 6-for-14 isn't good, but isn't terrible. It's 40%, something like that. Caleb Martin, 1-for-7. Max Strus, 0-for-10. Duncan Robinson, 1-for-6.
Yeah.
So when your shooters are 2-for-17, 2-for-23, you're not going to win any games. A lot was made of the fact that Miami only got 2 free throws. They didn't go to the basket. Yeah. They took jump shots that missed. That was, look, I'm going to have to say this at some point on television today. I told Wilbon yesterday on the air, I sort of think Miami has to win this one. And if Miami doesn't win this one, I'm thinking it's a 5-game series. Now, you can come back with what I'm going to say now, and I will accept it because it's my same theory, that the altitude will be less significant to Miami in the second game than in the first game. I accept that. So maybe they have a better chance in game two. But I will tell you that if they don't win game two, the series is over. Because Nikola Jokic, you know, if you put a zone on him, he'll have 20 assists.
Yes.
20 assists. He's better than everybody else. And I just want to say this. After months of listening to Wilbon and others talk about Joel Embiid as the MVP, he's sitting on his can in the crib. And no, Jokic is out there. Now they all say he's the best in the world.
Yeah.
Do you think he wasn't the best in the world 2 weeks ago?
He should have won 3 MVPs in a row.
Of course.
I mean, he had 10 assists in the first half.
Of course.
He only took 3 shots in the first half. They were up 17.
They were up.
Yeah. He does whatever he needs to do.
Michael.
And does not look like the world's best basketball player. If you saw him walking down the street, you'd be like, oh, there's a tall white guy. But you probably would not think, like, that's the world's best basketball player.
He is right now.
But he is.
Yeah.
He is right now. He may not be 1-on-1. But 5-on-5, totally. He's the best basketball player in the world. You want to, you want to plug your book? Isn't that why you're here?
Me?
Yeah. Well, you're the only one with a book.
I mean, I'm happy to plug a book. Yes, my
Take
book
30
is called.
Seconds,
my
and
book
we're
is
moving
my,
on.
My book is called Power Players.
Do you remember the name of your
no,
own book?
No. Yes, I do remember the name. Sports, Politics, and the American Presidency.
Are you going to bring a couple of signed copies to Luke's event in Rockville?
always.
Ride the wave.
Hey, everybody. Remember me? This is a lot like Look For Me There.
Yeah.
It has been out a month. It has done extremely well. As I always say, it's not Luke Russert level success,
right?
But it has done extremely well for Chris Saliza level success.
That's great. That's
fantastic. And it's about the sports presidents played, loved, and spectated, and what it tells us about who they are and how they govern. Thank you.
Okay.
I thought Michael had written something I didn't know about. Maybe it's self-published.
What are our thoughts of Rose Zhang birdieing 18 and finishing -2 in her first round ever as a pro?
It's exactly what you expect from her, which is she's probably had the greatest amateur career in any side of golf, except for maybe Tiger Woods, and it's up there.
Oh no! Do you want to know something interesting about Tiger Woods and Rose Zhang? Both spent 2 years at Stanford. Rose won one more tournament than Tiger won in less starts.
And you look at the timeline for her turning pro, and you realize there's one piece that was missing on the resume, which is a tournament that is still new to the golf world, which was the Augusta National Women's Amateur. So that probably delayed her professional debut. It came with a lot of birdies. It came with some bogeys, which is the learning curve to playing anything at the professional level. More than that, you just saw how she dealt with the media, and she has been. She has been ready for this for a long time, so it's really exciting to see what she does this summer. Where in the women's game, you see a lot of success when these players are young.
Mike and I both thought she'd be lucky to make the cut. She's going to make the cut. When she stopped playing yesterday, she was in fifth place. She's going to make the cut. She's going to be a great player, and what a lovely place to debut at Liberty National. And it's on the Golf Channel because the views are so great. They want to show the course whenever they can. You know, did you have any particular thoughts about any part of her game?
This is not necessarily specific to her debut yesterday, but her iron play is unbelievable to watch. She does not miss shots long, short. She is just incredibly steady with that. It comes down to putting. You saw yesterday she did not make some of the putts that you thought, but she creates a lot of highlights. She had a big chip-in birdie on one of the par fives, I think. So, no, it's great for the sport.
Do you think she'll be a winning player, that she will win tournaments, maybe even win majors?
Yeah, I totally do.
Yeah.
She's been playing against these. If you look at how strong the amateur game has become, it really is the precursor to the pro level in terms of teaching you how to win, teaching you how to win against the best. It's why you see some of the same players who are at the, you know, U.S. amateur, the women's amateur at Augusta year in, year out. And you look at what practicing with that group of players and women on her Stanford team means for her, which is she's already been playing against the best.
We are partial to her. Because she's won two tournaments in this area, though. She's not from here.
No.
She won the women's AM against much older people.
Yeah, won the AM Woodmont, first.
And she won the... After she won the women's AM against older people, she played the U.S. Junior Girls at Columbia and won that. I mean, whatever was out there, she won it. Now, she tended to have her dad on the bag until she got Doug Herson on the bag. She's got somebody else now. I don't know what the nature of that contract is. I'll probably try to subvert it if I could. But she's got somebody else on the bag and not Doug.
Doug is ready and able. When we had a matchup at Woodmont, we saw pictures of Rose as you're walking through like the foyer, through the pro shop. He immediately got out, texted her just to say, I'm still here, ready to go.
And so, you know, so we
did. Were you ever in the bag for Michael? Did I miss that?
There was one time where I had suffered an injury. This was at a Columbia, you know, Columbia Junior Club Championship. And you, let's just say there by the 12th hole, I think
exhausted.
I bladed sandwich, you know, and 10, 11, 12, long up and downs, bladed a wedge. And I think that's when we stopped talking. We shut it down.
Yeah. So
smart. Good communication.
The distance between player and caddy got a little wider.
Yeah, that's what the relationship you want with your caddy.
Oh yeah.
Silence.
Well, I would never tell him what to do anyway. What can I tell him that he doesn't
right.
know?
Here's how you don't
like if
hit
he would say to me, what do you think of this putt? You know, can you read it? You know, I would try, but I wouldn't, you know. I putt almost as quickly as Kevin Sheehan. Kevin just walks up to it and just slams it. So, all right, we'll take a break. So we have, I didn't even ask Chris. Can I just get 1 minute with Chris on this?
Of course.
We've settled this debt ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
Can you just explain what that means?
Yeah, so, okay, the way to think of it very simply is it's like the nation's credit card. This is money that has already been spent that the government is essentially allotting to pay off. Like, this is not money that the government is going to spend. This is money that has already been spent. The reason that it becomes a thing is because Congress has to approve it. And because Congress has to approve it, Congress uses it as a pinch point, particularly when the president is one party and the Congress is the other, like Republican-controlled House, Joe Biden in the White House. They use it as a pinch point to try to get spending priorities passed. So all that you saw happen was Biden said, we're not going to negotiate. We're just going to raise it. We're going to raise what we can spend on the credit card. And Republicans said, well, we're not doing that. We want spending cuts. They came to the table. There are spending cuts. And that's it. You won't hear about it until after the 2024 election. It was full of sound and fury signifying very, very little, to be totally honest. It was all this talk about how we're going to, if we default as a nation, we can't pay.
Yeah, that's what Janet Yellen said.
We can't pay our bills effectively, and it hurts your credit rating, and it can hurt the economy. And that's, we've never defaulted as a country. I hesitate to say we never will, but I think it's sufficiently scary in terms of the outcomes that it's very unlikely that we would.
Can I ask the sort of an obvious question?
I hope I can answer it.
Bill Clinton wasn't president that long ago. We had a surplus.
Yep.
We had a surplus when Bill Clinton was president. What are we in debt now?
$30 trillion.
How did that happen? I can look,
but it there's a debt calculator that is constantly updating. That is one
how
of the most
did that happen
things.
In 2025? How did that happen?
We spent a
what
lot
are we spending
money.
On lattes? What are we doing?
We are currently in debt $31 trillion. Yes, we had that right.
We had a surplus.
Yes, in 1996.
It's not like one party's responsible for this. The Republicans and the Democrats did this because we've had Republican and Democratic presidents.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How did we go from plus to minus $30 trillion?
And
that can't all be paying off student loans.
And by the way, state budgets, this is nerdy, but state budgets have to balance. So you can't run a deficit in a state. So if you're the governor of a state, you have to find a way to make your...
Shouldn't the federal government...
And the federal government just is like, well, we'll just print more money.
Except for wars.
Well, and that's been a big spender of money.
But there's other things.
Yes.
We were plus.
Yeah.
With 30 trillion down.
30, 31, almost 32 trillion. I mean, it's just unimaginable amount of money.
So does that mean like someone comes, if they can't pay, that someone comes and repossesses the United States?
Yeah, repo man. Yeah, there's a repo man coming. Big repo man. Yeah, it's stunning. But anyway, that's think of it like a credit card that you've already rung up a bunch of bills on. You're just paying it. That's it.
So it's not nearly as big a deal as they made it seem.
It would be a big deal if we defaulted. But we're not. But we're not. It passed the Senate last night. Right. It's extremely... Biden will sign it, and that'll be it. Okay.
It won't be an election issue.
No, it will not be. It will be after the 2024 election.
Okay. Yep. Well, let's get out of here. Who do we have next?
Evan. Evan Drellick, yes.
Evan Drellick is going to be with us. He's going to talk about this thing that is very interesting to me. It's small, but it's interesting. All of these regional sports networks are defaulting.
Yes.
They're defaulting.
Padres.
And Major League Baseball is going to have to take over. So Evan will join us when we return.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is a song called Red Coat, right?
Yes.
It's a band, Irish band, called the Forge, F-O-R-G-E, Hounds. The Forge Hounds.
The Forge Hounds, yes.
This is a song that was written and recorded by Paul Bolger in the mid-90s. Under the name Bolger. But some of these guys played on it.
Yes.
So
yes,
they come back with reworking. The new arrangement expands on the original with Mick Wall's lead guitar taking over for the harmonica-driven riffs of Nick Kinsella from the original. It's a big sound.
Yes, it is.
It's a big sound. The Forge Hounds. They're influenced by the likes of ZZ Top, Bad Company, Thin Lizzy, Hanoi Rocks, and Deep Purple. Thin Lizzy. The boys are back in town.
Yes,
Thin Lizzy.
Yes.
I love that song.
It's a great song.
I love that song.
Isn't it?
These are the Forge Hounds. How cool is this? Send us some more stuff. They play in Evan Drellick. Now, let me just set this up by saying I am concerned about all these regional sports networks going bankrupt and Major League Baseball having to take over the day-to-day of the broadcast, television broadcast. So we called Finesand. And Finesand said, I don't know that much about it, but there's this guy at the Athletics, friend of mine, Evan Drellick, and he knows all about it. So I said, okay, let's book him. And then I find out that he went to Binghamton. You went to Binghamton and you interviewed me? What?
Yes, for Pipe Dream, the student newspaper 15 years ago. I remember exactly where I was when I did it. And so this has always been the lifelong dream, Tony, that finally I would do something that would make Daddy take notice, that Tony, the king of Binghamton sports media, would pay attention to. And, you know, I find it's a little odd that the thing that finally does it is 2 days of lawyers arguing over television rights in a courtroom, as opposed to anything else in my career, like, oh, I don't know, breaking the Houston Astros cheating scandal story. That didn't do it for you, but this does it. So I'm happy to talk TV rights with you.
Well, let's mention, you have a book out about the Houston Astros thing. Tell us the name of the book and where people can get it.
Winning Fixes Everything, How Baseball's Brightest Minds Created Sport's Biggest Mess. And it's explaining how the hell did we get here. It's the Astros scandal and everything that leads up to it. So, you know, if you're into behind-the-scenes front office culture and culture run amok, I think you'll like it.
That's great. I hope that does well. But more importantly, was Scotch and Sirloin still there on Vestal Parkway when you went to Binghamton?
I want to say it was. The name is familiar. I don't know if it's because you mentioned it to me in that interview I did or not. But, you know, the Speedy joints, those are all still there.
Oh, yeah. But they changed Speedies. They made them mostly chicken instead of lamb. They're not as good. You know, but we still get Lupo's Speedy Sauce sent to us, and we base things in it all the time. All the time. So yeah, you interviewed me. I hope that I was self-inflated and boring. I hope.
You gave one quote that still sticks with me, where I think I was asking about the end of your career, and you said, you know, when I retire, I'm just going to move up to Binghamton, and I'm just going to yodel. I'm just going to sit there and teach these kids something, and I'm just going to be an old man yodeling. And that image, you know, you have a little bit of a way with words, so that always stuck with me.
So I'm actually going to go to Binghamton in a few weeks, and I'm going to play in the Dick's Sporting Goods Pro-Am with Harvey Stanger. I mean, I'm not looking forward to the drive, but I'm looking forward to doing that. Have you ever played in that?
You know, I played one set of nine in my life. I tried to hit the thing like a baseball, so I should learn how to golf, but no, I'm aware of it. I probably wrote about it, taking agate at the Press and Sun Bulletin across the street, but no, I've never played them.
It's fascinating to me. Nobody else cares about this, but the Press and Sun Bulletin was right across Vestal Parkway from Binghamton University, and we had a baseball player once. Our baseball field then, not now, because our baseball field now is a $50 million baseball field, but our baseball field then was facing Miller Motor Dodge, which was across the street. Do you remember Miller Motor Dodge, Evan?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and we had a baseball player, a catcher named Louis Giambalvo, who later went on to become a very good actor and did a lot of like mob movies. Louis Giambalvo, L-O-U-I-S, Giambalvo, G-I-A-M. And Giambalvo. And he hit one to Vestal Parkway. It went across. It went across right into the, you know, the car lot of Miller Motor Dodge. Anyway, I'm getting off the topic. How did you get this job with the Athletic? That's a good job. How did you get that?
Yeah, I moved around. I climbed. I climbed the ladder. I was a beat writer covering the Astros, covering the Red Sox. I lived in L.A. It's been all of this is just so you'd pay attention, right? This is the payoff right here.
I'm paying attention. I'm putting you
attention
on the show.
Attention must be paid.
Yeah, right. It's Arthur Miller should write about you, except he's no longer writing. All right, how many of the local TV outlets? I don't know how many there are. I sort of doubt there's 30, but maybe there are 30. How many of them are in trouble, and are they all sort of related to Sinclair?
Yeah, all right. So Sinclair, Bally, Diamond, this is all the same nomenclature for the sake of this conversation. They had 14 RSNs. Now it's 13. The one difference being they no longer have the Padres. MLB has taken over the Padres, and what we had in court now was an argument related to four of those remaining 13 specifically. The Guardians, the Rangers, the Diamondbacks, and the Twins, because Diamond is in bankruptcy, and they're trying to restructure it. And they're saying, I don't want to pay these teams anymore. So that's what these last 2 days in court were about, was MLB fighting with Diamond over, do you still have to pay us the full amount of money? And a judge, by the way, said, yes, you do.
Okay, so I read a story in the Post about this, and I find the argument that the regional sports networks make insane. You signed a contract, and okay, it's not worth as much anymore. You signed the contract hoping it would go the other way so that you could laugh about it and buy expensive suits. You need you either pay it or you get out of the business, right, Evan? Isn't it that simple?
Well, that's basically what the judge said, is that it is not my position or this court's position to be determining the fair market value of every contract. And so that's why he rules against the RSNs and Diamond here and saying, you know, exactly what you're saying. You signed it. You have to live with it.
Yeah.
He's imploring them to keep talking. And MLB tried to buy all these RSNs back. Diamond didn't like the offer. But you could see a world where those conversations continue and that MLB reaches some sort of settlement and takes all these rights back themselves.
Okay. So now, the games that I watch on television in Washington, D.C., the Nats and the O's, that's Masson. They're not bankrupt, right? We're not talking about them. Or is this going to be a wave that knocks out everybody?
Well, there's this larger issue here of cord cutting and the whole change in consumer dynamic. I subscribe to YouTube TV. I no longer have Time Warner Cable, which I grew up with in New York City. So the whole mode of consumption for people is changing, and that changes the economics behind it. What one of the things you're seeing with the Padres, Bally gives the rights back to MLB. MLB is broadcasting it. Well, if you now live in San Diego, You don't have to sign up for Time Warner Cable or whoever else is out there anymore. You can just buy the package from MLB. And you couldn't do that before in market. And so we're what's going to happen as all these deals come up and whatever goes on with the Diamond bankruptcy is ideally you're going to get to a world where it is easier for you as a fan at home to sign up for these games. You don't have to go to Time Warner Cable. You can just pay the money directly and get your season's worth of games if you are in that team city.
Well, that's what the guy who bought the Phoenix Suns wants to do, and a court stopped him from doing it. Are you familiar with that?
You know, I haven't followed that one as closely. Okay. I remember he wanted to do it for free, as I recall.
Yes, for free.
And this would not be for free.
Okay.
I there are all sorts of contractual arrangements that prevent you from doing it now. That the reason MLB could do it with the Padres now, they got the rights back. And you need these existing contracts to all expire or be handed back to you by a company in bankruptcy.
Okay. Evan, can you foresee a time when Major League Baseball will pick the announcers, will direct it and produce it and staff it and be in the television business for maybe half of their teams?
You know, that's an interesting question that I don't really know the answer to, in the sense that you could see MLB deciding we want to hold on to these rights. What they're saying is that they don't, that they never intended to be in the TV business. What I think they ultimately do want to be able to do is put together a package. The league sells a package of whatever, 20, they would love to have 30 teams that you can sign up in one place, and it doesn't matter where in the country you are, it's blackout free. There's a lot of hurdles to get to that point. But does MLB want to actually be in the television production business for a variety of teams? I think there's reason to be skeptical of that.
Well, let's look at the Padres, since they are the first domino to fall in this. Have they kept their announcing crew? Have they kept their directors and producers? Is everything situation normal, or did MLB, are they going to change anything?
So the in-game announcers, Don Arcillo, go down the list, in San Diego, and this is the case for some other teams as well, are team employees. They are not actually Bally Sports, whatever, employees. So that was seamless. It wouldn't always be seamless if it was a different team. It depends on whether they're a direct employee of that RSN, the Regional Sports Network, or of the team. But in the case of the Padres, it's a pretty smooth transition. A lot of the TV crew, as I understand it, are freelancers. And, well, you know, you can pick up a freelancer the next day.
Sure.
So a little changeover, I think, behind the scenes. But as far as who you're listening to every night in San Diego, the same.
So, but I want to stress this again, that the aim down the road of baseball would be to sell packages directly to consumers to bypass cable. And this is stuff I don't really understand, so I won't use words like streaming, but to make it available so for an X amount of fee, you get all the baseball you want. Yes?
That's basically right, with the caveat that MLB likes when RSNs pay them. They want to still get money from regional sports networks and cable, but they want to also have the right to distribute it in that package, so that, you know, they have a problem here, and they're finally publicly admitting they have a problem, which is you can't sit anywhere in this country right now and get any baseball game you want. That's kind of silly in this day and age, that you have people who want your product and they can't pay for it. And so they're trying to get to a way where they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want the cable companies to pay them, and they want to be able to sell that type of package.
It's unbelievable how much money these people paid the baseball teams. Of course they went bankrupt. It's just simply unbelievable. I mean, in reading this story, some guy thought they'd make $280 million and they made 11. You know, and you just go, what? And like, it's like the executives of these companies are dopes, right?
Well, the amount of debt that, particularly in the case of Sinclair and Bally, that was taken out in that deal, I think by virtually every account, is crippling. Right? They bought these things as cord cutting was starting, and they took out a huge amount of debt on it. So yeah, what would you think would happen? But there is something to remember here, which is, you know, look, you know, in a weird way, you were a beneficiary of this at ESPN and everybody at ESPN for years. If you signed up for cable, But before the rise of all these streaming services, you know, you had to pay for ESPN.
Yeah.
You had to pay for the baseball team, even if you weren't a baseball fan.
If you didn't watch it, yeah.
That's a lot of benefit to everybody involved, to the baseball teams, to the RSNs. Everybody was making money because you had to pay for the bundle.
It's gone now.
Yep.
My career is going down the drain, but look how long it lasted. How lucky was I? Evan, thank you. Do you mind if we call you back at some point and bring you back on? I like you.
Tony, I would love it. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Evan Drellick, boys and girls, we'll take a break. We're going crazy today. We're going to NASA next. Noah Petro is going to talk about UFOs. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
In celebration of opening day, we've got a special episode of the Moth Podcast for you. The theme is baseball and the surprising ways it connects people.
I gaze out at the players on the field, and then I look over at my dad, and I realize that in the silence between us that something has changed. It's like I'm seeing him for the first time.
Two stories about baseball, family, and so much more. The episode's available right now. Subscribe to the Moth Podcast to make sure you hear it.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony Kornheiser Show.
Pat Riley had the coolest hair in the history of the NBA. Los Angeles, New York City, Miami's where he made his hay. Coolest clothes, silks and leathers, polyesters and vinyls. He's been involved in 25% of all the NBA finals. Ooh, Pat Riley, I wanna be as cool as you. As cool as John Lennon's boots or Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes. You won as a player with Wilt and as a coach of magic tricks. Then you coach Pat Ewing, Charles Oakley, and the bad boy Knicks. With the Heat you brought in Shaq, LeBron, and Jimmy Butler too. I wanna be cool like Riley, but I ain't got much of a hairdo. Ooh, Pat Riley, I wanna be as cool as you. As cool as John Lennon's boots or Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes. Cool as John Lennon's boots or Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes.
The brilliant Dan Byrne, who writes, I'd written a song about the Celtics winning Game 7, but obviously I had to toss that in the trash. So I wrote this instead. Had a great time at La Cheeserie Tuesday afternoon. Michael Sands couldn't have been nicer and more welcoming and regaled us with some legendary La Cheeserie stories afterwards, not to mention a heaping plate of cheeses. And there were a distinguished gathering of littles who sang along to several cheese songs, plus Wembanyama and Barry Bonds. And he said, I'm in the Outer Banks to play the Down the Hatch Festival hosted by the Pat McGee Band, who you've played on the show. I gave Pat a hunk of Gruyere from La Cheeserie, which he loved. Damn.
And by the way, his next gig is on June 6th in Piermont, New York. I'm assuming that's upstate.
I don't know where that is.
Anyways.
I don't know that.
Yes, there
Piermont,
you go.
New York. I'm unfamiliar with Piermont, New York. That's, of course, cool like Riley. Pat Riley is the coolest guy. Noah Petro, who is our man at NASA, calls us now, gets on with us now. We called him, actually. And it's about UFOs. Like, it's about UFOs because apparently, Noah, there's a report that has been released identifying X amount of things that we don't know what they are. Can you explain that?
Sure, yeah. So the event that happened earlier this week was a press conference. The full report, hundreds of pages of documentation, will come out later this summer. And so this first kind of presentation of the findings was NASA's attempt to understand what these, we call them now UAP, Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena. We've all seen the videos from airplanes of things that we just can't recognize, don't know what they are. And so what NASA did is say, hey, let's take our resources. We're a very good agency at understanding data and try to understand what's happening here. And so by sifting through these reports that have been collected over decades to try to put science behind them, to say, well, what is it that we're seeing? And ultimately, the bottom line is that about 1% of all of these reports that come in, we cannot quantify. And so then what do we do? And we say, well, we need better data. We need access to better data, but that we're taking these things seriously and looking at them scientifically and trying to understand exactly what's going on.
So this is, to me, a critical question. Mm-hmm. Do NASA people have an open mind to the possibility that these things are from somewhere else, intelligent life somewhere else? Or did they get behind closed doors and laugh, say, what a bunch of dopes. They think this could happen. This is crazy. These people are crazy. What is the mindset in NASA?
Well, I can't speak for the folks on that committee. I can only say that, you know, I'll tell you, there's probably an apocryphal story of Neil Armstrong when he was going to the moon that a friend of his said, hey, Neil, when you get up on the moon, say, hey, what's that? What's that moving around? Because then you'd never have to worry about NASA's budget for the rest of the time, right? there's a certain sense but you know, we are curious people and we want to know what's going on. I don't think anyone within NASA says, oh, this is junk. This is
right.
We want to know, and so there is a curiosity that everybody who's even affiliated with NASA has. Scott Kelly, who was a former astronaut,
senator now. His brother's a senator.
Confusing. They're twins. It's hard to tell. But he talked about an experience where he was flying and he saw something anomalous, and so he and his co-pilot investigated and turned out to be a Bart Simpson balloon. Right. So I think that level of curiosity, we want to know what these things are. Because the detection of whether it's human made or whether it comes from a far afield, that's the cause for what NASA is for, is understanding our place in the universe. And part of that, and NASA has spent years, decades trying to understand, hey, where can there be life in the solar system and in other solar systems? And finally, NASA has, I think, embraced the idea that this is part of that search for our place in the universe. So I think it's just an extension of what we do.
I think we should be open to the possibility that there's intelligent life somewhere else and that they could be. We would send stuff to them if we knew mm-hmm. they were out there. We'd send stuff to them. They'd probably shoot it down. but if we would send stuff to them, doesn't it make sense that if it exists, they might send stuff to us? Yes?
Absolutely. And, you know, that's the... You know, part of NASA's search has been both passive listening. You know, we're all familiar with Contact, of the Carl Sagan book and movie of listening out in space, listening for some sign.
Right.
And this is an extension of that, looking for those signs. You know, we talked last time about James Webb Space Telescope. We talked about all of the things that NASA actually does to look for chemical signatures of life in this universe. And this is part of it. And sure, they would send things to us. We have sent things out of our solar system.
Yeah.
Remember, Voyager has the gold record on it. In case somebody, you know, some alien civilization has a record player, they could listen to Chuck Berry, right? Like, there are things that we have done to try to push ourselves out into the universe. And this study is just a part of that extension of, hey, yeah, let's take it seriously and understand what's going on here.
I really liked UFOs. Unidentified mm-hmm. flying object. When you change the name to what you changed it to, it sanitizes it and de-scares it. I don't think that's a good idea.
Well, I'll tell you a personal story of a UFO. And is private. I live near National Airport, so I see planes land and fly all the time. I'm used to seeing things in the sky. And one time I'm driving and I see three lights lined up and I think, well, those are airplanes, but they're not blinking. And there's nothing happening on, immediately it becomes an unidentified flying object. It's something right. that's flying, it's unidentified.
Right.
And I start driving after them. It's nuts. What am I doing? But it turned out to be lanterns, sky lanterns that are floating through the sky. Oh, like I was relieved, and then I was worried that they'd crash into the woods and burn everything down, but they did.
Right.
But by changing the name, it also broadens it out, because we know that there's weird things that are observed or measured under the ocean or deep in space. And so by broadening it from just things that are flying, and this is NASA as well, right? We love to have acronyms for everything, but it's now broader than just flying. It's, hey, there's this unusual noise that was recorded in the ocean.
Okay.
And so it tries to cast a broader net of all things that are observed that it makes us scratch our head and say, we need to look a little bit more carefully at this to say, oh, this is someone saw Venus and took a picture through a shaky cell phone picture, or this is a whale song that someone recorded. Yeah, you know, try to understand our place on the planet and in the universe.
I can't believe there's a pilot alive who hasn't, mm-hmm. after a flight, said to people in the cockpit, what was that? Right?
And actually, there's an interesting part of this is also to destigmatize a lot of these things. Apparently, there is this common thread among pilots of just keeping your mouth shut because you don't want to be that person.
Yes, I understand that. I understand that they would be afraid that people would think they were crazy. Yeah.
And so trying to normalize this and say, hey, talk about it, because then we can find out what it was. Was it a private airplane, a Bart Simpson balloon, whatever it was, and make it part of this rich data set that we're collecting. NASA's about going out and getting data, and this is trying to open the barn door saying, hey, bring in your observations and let's try to understand exactly what's going on here.
I'm sure that what I'm going to say now is right, that anybody who has seen the great movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind believes completely that this is possible. Not that they would look like that, you know, not the spaceship stuff, but you come to realize, wow, you can't automatically say this can't happen, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a very, you know, again, trying not to be like cold and mathematical about it. You know, just think about statistics. It's not just a 50-50 proposition, although in some cases it is there or isn't there? But we've found so many planets around other stars. 20 years ago, we had effectively no exoplanets, planets around other stars. Now we know there are hundreds of thousands and thousands of planets. We haven't found any that look exactly like Earth. All of this also points to how special the Earth is to have life, to host life. The chances that there's no other place in the solar system that can have life. And again, there's an important distinction between life that looks like you and I, sentient beings like in Close Encounters, and microbes and bacteria and the very... Somewhere is a mix of all of these things. And so I think it's highly unlikely that there would be nothing out in the whole universe that can host some form of life. And again, whether or not it's evolved to the point to communicate, to do interstellar space travel, you know, that I find harder to believe. But again, there's a famous quote, and I'll butcher it, but you know, there's two possibilities. Either we're alone or we're not, and either are equally terrifying, because if we are alone in the universe, that tells us how incredibly unique and special this planet is. And by golly, if we are alone, boy, that means that if this is the only planet in the entire universe that can sustain life, we better do a better job of taking care of it.
Noah, thank you so much. I know I sound like a moron when I ask these questions, but I appreciate that you will give answers to them. Thank you, Noah.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Noah Petro, boys and girls. We will take a break. We have email and jingle when we return. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk. No. You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Tony Kornheiser Show.
The Tony Kornheiser Show.
Here comes Tony's mailbag. Got your emails, faxes, and your notes. Here comes Tony's mailbag. Gonna read some.
It's Ronnie Neumeier and Tom Lofgren. I love that. Just love that. Najee, you want to do the Bethesda Bagel ad?
Bethesda Bagels. We love them. You will as well. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com for the location in the D.C. area nearest you. Then pop on in and you will be thrilled.
All right. So the song we have today, one of the verses goes like this. You'll start out standing, proud to steal her anything she sees. Start out standing, proud to steal her anything she sees. But you'll wind up peeking through the keyhole down upon your knees. This is Bob Dylan.
Is it?
Bob Dylan wrote this song, not this guy who dated Carol. Bob Dylan, I think his guy's name was Elliot, I don't even know. Bob Dylan wrote this song, and it's, you know, it starts out, she's got everything she needs, she's an artist, she don't look back. Well, Carol in high school was an art student and then went to become an art major in college. And so this guy palmed off Bob Dylan's lyrics
unbelievable.
As his own.
Seriously, like, the visions of Carol.
Think nobody would know that? Like, are you that stupid to think nobody would know that? This guy's, you know, I want to say this guy's probably a loser, but he probably is a hedge fund guy.
Private equity.
$7 billion.
He's on his yacht listening to the show right now.
Thanks to our guest today, Evan Drellich. Is it Drellich or Drellich or Drellich? How is it pronounced? I don't want to keep getting it wrong.
Drellich.
It's Drellich.
Yes.
Of The Athletic and our man from NASA, Noah Petro. Thanks to today's sponsors, Nuts.com and Harry's Razors. Remember, you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and Odyssey. If you get the show through Apple, please leave us a review.
So I have a new code for you.
What do you got?
It's time to walk to JohnnyO.com. The captain turns one. TK Captain 1.
How about that?
Graduation
going there now.
So Mike Gugod wants to send shoes to the captain.
I know, yes.
Isn't that lovely?
That's great.
Do you remember when he sent us Mizuno shoes like 15 years ago?
Yes, he wants to send shoes to the
Liz was
captain.
Already texting with Bonnie, so I think we have it taken care of.
George Mallet sent us a lovely
Love George.
Note. It made me so... You got to understand, George Mallet does a talk show in Indianapolis.
Yes.
So the Indy 500 is a big deal.
Yes.
To Indianapolis and George Mallet. Made me so happy to hear you talking about the Indianapolis 500. I was there in the Northwest Vista. My 11-year-old son and I rode our bikes to the race to avoid traffic and parking woes. The ride was nothing to Colt. His dad, though, is 62. Still, my wife's sons, my bonus sons, drove to the race, and we got back to the house roughly 3 hours before they did. Next year, why don't you bring your e-bike and come with us? Competing with a crowd of 300,000 gearheads is easy on two wheels. It was time for us to go to the big race. As you can see, I have the top drivers on my show, and I stalk them on a regular basis. The attached pictures of me with Graham Rahal, Mario Andretti, Al Unser Jr., and your boy A.J. Foyt. I wore a bow tie and a suit on pit row, and I'm pretty sure A.J. thought I was somebody more important than your average rum-dum. I heard he was grumpy, but found him to be unfailingly gracious. And he sends all these pictures. And all these guys, by the way, are small physically.
Well, yeah.
Got to fit in the car.
Got to fit in the car, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
There's no door.
That's exactly right.
Have you seen the ads for Gran Turismo they were on during the finals with Boban in the car? That made me laugh.
Boban is, he has no career as a basketball player, but if you want to put mustard on the top shelf, he's great at
He's
that.
A good ad guy.
From Don Campbell, Mr. Tony, a Ford freaking Pinto? Are you kidding me? I've been reading and listening to you since 1979. In 1977, with a since-gone brotherly friend, we drove my Ford Pinto wagon to Daytona, Florida for spring break. I was 16, going on 17. I told my dad I was only driving to Richmond to meet said friend and taking the bus from there. Everybody says that to their parents. Though I had disconnected and reconnected the odometer to reflect the mileage from Darnstown to Richmond and giving the car a thorough cleaning, he had me. The sand he collected from the inner wheel wells were from Daytona Beach, Florida. How he knew this, I still don't know. And he is also gone, and so I will never know. The Pinto was a huge step down from the 1970 Mustang Mach 1 that I owned as a 15-year-old. Long story. Drove 112 miles an hour on 404 on the way to the beach. Be proud of what you've done and accomplished. I still cherish the bandwagon articles and cried reading the Style Have a Catch article. Here's the deal. I also owned a Mustang. It wasn't a Mach 2 or anything like that. Mustangs came out when I was in high school. They were a revolutionary car. They cost $1,998. Valedictorian of my class, Scott Newman, because he was valedictorian, his parents bought him a Mustang, a yellow Mustang.
Wow.
He went to Yale, had a nervous breakdown because he was in a suite with four other valedictorians. This can do it to you. This can do it to you. But I bought a Mustang in the 70s. It had what is called a Landau roof. Does anybody here know what a Landau roof is? Okay, so it's a white car, and in the roof line, cut into the roof line, just the back part of the roof line going straight across as if it were just a piece of plastic. It didn't extend onto the roof, the front of the roof. Like, it wasn't a two-tone car in the sense that the roof was red and the body was white, but it had a red sort of rubberish thing called a Landau roof with an opera window. An opera window is a window that gives you nothing to look out of. It's just decorative. And it had this red, over sweater on top of the roof. And I had a Mustang and liked the Mustang very much. In those days, of course, I didn't have a bad back, so it was okay for me to get into a low car. So I owned a Pinto and I owned a Mustang. That was nice. This is a note from Crystal Westergaard.
Is this... That's what we're talking
That's
about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Show that to
Nigel,
the boys.
Let me see.
But it didn't have the... It was not on the hood.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It was not on the hood. Sure, sure. It was a Landau roof.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
From Crystal Westergaard. Hi, I had to listen to your episode where you had a box of bars. Those are Reggie bars. It had some buzz that even reached way over to where I live. I did note that you didn't know who made them or where, and of course that is written on the wrapper, but in case you've long since eaten them, we make them, and we hired a factory near Hershey, Pennsylvania to do it for us. Us and Reggie, of course. Our company name is American Candy Nostalgia. I love the part of the show where one fellow had a rant about sports news being second or third fiddle back in the 70s, and now it was real news. And I thought, well, if it's real news, then accuracy matters. And if accuracy matters, I better write in and offer to set the record straight. Thanks for having it on your show. Have you actually eaten it yet? I challenge the Snickers bar in a head-to-head with our bar any day. I've mentioned this a number of times, that the Reggie bar is really good, and it's much like a Snickers bar.
Yes.
But if you make nostalgic candy, what else do you make, Crystal? Yes. I mean, what are the sorts of candies? For example, I don't know if what I'm going to say now is still made, but people who know me and know this show know that I used to often say that my favorite candy bar growing up was something called the Sky Bar.
Oh, that's
yes,
right.
It was all the different candy bars. I remember those.
Different
yes.
insides that's in right. chocolate.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't know that. If that is still made. That was a Necco product.
Yes.
And that would be nostalgic for me, the right. Sky Bar. Crystal, if you're listening, nostalgic simply for me. From Ira Piller, a few weeks ago you reminisced about the New York Knicks back in the 80s and 70s. You spoke fondly of Red Holzman, Red Auerbach, and the heritage of the New York City basketball coaching fraternity. One Red you did not mention, not your fault, was Red Saracek, who had a special place in my youth. Saracek was the longtime coach at Yeshiva University and New York coaching legend. He was also the sports director of my summer camp of my youth, Camp Alomar in Stormville, New York, which is in Dutchess County. When I was camper there in the late 50s and early 60s, every summer Red would bring up the St. John's team to play the counselors team and offer clinics to the campers. Joe Lapchick, then the St. John's coach, was a good friend of Saracek's, as were Holtzman and Auerbach. I remember Leroy Ellis coming up to camp and another player, Tony Jackson. These guys were All-Americans, first team All-Americans, St. John's, who was a superb shooter. What a thrill to see those college stars playing right in our camp, social all basketball court, never to be forgotten. Camp Alomar has been closed for decades, but the memories last forever. You know, so that's nice from Ira Piller. Who's
by the way,
Clearwater, Florida.
Yeah. Sky Bar
still
discontinued in 2018.
Oh.
But I could get you a box of 24 for under $50.
But they're old. They're like five.
Don't worry
years
about
old.
That.
Yeah. Does it really go bad?
They don't chocolate. Ship it until the fall because the stuff melts. So I get you some in the fall. I have to wait the summer out.
This is from Noah Merle. This Sunday, June 4th. That's this Sunday.
That's this Sunday, yes.
I will be becoming a man. And as one does around these milestone numbers, I've recently found myself looking back on my life to this point with a great deal of nostalgia. I feel compelled to write in and say thank you, even if it's only Nigel who reads this. Sad thing to say, but there are only a very small number of voices who I've listened to over the past 22 years more than yours, including my real-life human relationships. I was an 18-year-old freshman at Cal Berkeley playing soccer when I was introduced to you as PTI first aired, and it was the first show I recorded on my first-generation TiVo at the time, while my roommate was recording MTV dating shows like Singled Out and The Fifth Wheel. Just ask Michael. Do you know these shows?
Yeah.
I brought you and PTI with me to Seattle through a few years as a professional soccer player and wasn't even deterred by your unbelievably stupid population theory about my sport. I was in my late 20s when I moved to Baltimore for grad school to become a psychotherapist and was introduced to your radio show and podcast while still never missing an episode of the TV show. My proximity to the 20015 allowed me to finally understand at least a few of your local weather and traffic complaints. I was in my early 30s when I had an email read on the air, "Eat it, Kyle," and you, Gary, and Aldridge helped me name my second child, a masculine child, only after calling the list of name options I provided trust fund names, and I still find absolutely perfect.
I'd like that list.
We went with Easton after Aldridge's reference to the Easton Assassin. That was Larry Holmes was the Easton Assassin.
Yes.
So I will forever have a daily reminder of my own David Aldridge moment. Now I find myself becoming a man back in California, married with three children, all similar in age to your grandchildren, and still listening to your voice as much as just about anyone in my life. I recently started my own private practice business as a therapist for athletes. I truly believe your humanness and perspective on sports and life have shaped my thoughts and opinions in more ways than I would like to admit. So as I sit here nostalgically wondering how many hours of my life I've wasted listening to an old, bald, orange man yap, I just wanted to say thank you for all the smart and funny things you've provided for me over the past 22 years. Sorry for the long email. Maybe it's for a Thursday show. But thank you. And thank you to all the other smart and funny people you have surrounded yourself with and brought into my life alongside you, which is an incredible list and obviously excludes Lace Saliza. Just wanted to do it for you, Chris.
Thanks a lot, jerk.
Noah
happy
Merle,
birthday.
Alameda, California. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
If I wish one of your guys had children, if I could kick them in their head or stomp on their testicles so you could feel my pain, because that's the pain I have waking up every day.
it going, breathing down our necks, handling our lives with a two-way secret calling code against our father's knives. Gonna run, gonna hide, going underground. We're gonna try and take this man, we're slowing it down. Sugarloaf, not far from here, found out burning bright. With a horse that carries a red coat fear, will it make us fight? Gonna run, gonna hide, going on the ground. Gonna try and take this man, we're slowing down, and he's going down. All we ever wanted was a free and easy life in the country of our ancestors, in the land free of strife. But the red coat came and he walked our earth, and he showed us no respect, treated us like dirt. Gonna run, gonna hide, going on the ground. We're gonna hunt and put this man into the ground. He's going down. For our lives, his horse threw his red coat fear, chopping up our knives. He loads his gun, comes up behind, too slow to run, and keep his musket primed. He aims his gun, but we paint our knives with the blood of red coat lives. Red coat.
Pat Riley had the coolest hair in the history of the NBA. Los Angeles, New York City, Miami's where he made his hay. Coolest clothes, silks and leathers, polyesters and vinyls. He's been involved in 25% of all the NBA finals. Ooh, Pat Riley, I wanna be as cool as you. As cool as John Lennon's boots or Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes. You won as a player with Wilt and as a coach of magic tricks. Then you coached Pat Ewing, Charles Oakley, and the bad boy Knicks. With the heat you brought in Shaq, LeBron, and Jimmy Butler too. I wanna be cool like Riley, but I ain't got much of a hairdo. Pat Riley, I wanna be as cool as you. As cool as John Lennon's boots or Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes. Cool as John Lennon's boots or Elvis Presley's blue suede shoes.